episode 11 of the Woke-ish podcast. This is Ebony.
And this is Zalma.
So this week we will be discussing the thin line between diversity and tokenism.
Yes.
But before we get there, we will start with our shout-out segment.
Yeah, and so our first shout-out goes to Cypress Hill, who will be receiving a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And it makes them the first Latino hip-hop group to do so. Yeah, so shout-out to Cypress Hill. I think I'm a little too young for Cypress Hill to be, like, because, you know, I'm Latino, and I was like, man, why weren't they that much? Yeah. I know a couple songs, but I don't think that I was, like, old enough where I could really enjoy them the same way. So I think, like, if I was maybe 10 years older, I would have been able to enjoy them in a period of my life. But I still think it's really cool. And so shout out to them for doing that. It's like, I don't know the names, but if I hear it and I see that it's Cypress Hill, I'm like, oh, okay.
The songs are in Spanish?
No, they're in English.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I think we're like too young.
Oh, okay. Okay, because I'm like, why? I mean, I've heard the name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're old enough to know the name and the references to them, but not, but you're too young to like know their songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you are huge Cypress Hill fans and you're like rolling your eyes at us saying that we're too young, just, you know. Yeah, but we still appreciate whenever they make like, they're making history, so shout out to them.
Yeah, shout out. Okay, and then our second shout out goes to Bernie Sanders, who's leading right now in the DNC race, I guess, to raise money for his campaign. So he, his campaign so far has raised $18.2 million, and Kamala Harris has raised $12 million so far. So shout out to both of them. Yeah, and so the amount that they raise is important because of the new DNC rules that outline how candidates can qualify for the first two debates. So they have to either receive at least 1% support in three DNC approved polls, or receive donations from at least 65,000 unique donors with a minimum of 200 donors in at least 20 different states.
Wow, that's a lot of rules.
It's hella complicated. And so apparently if they don't make the cut by the first debate, they can make it by the second one.
Okay.
So that's why they're kind of like, and I'm on Bernie Sanders' mailing list, and I'm getting and so I get like emails and text messages like every other day.
This team's hard at work.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, the unique donors piece is interesting. So it's like, even if I donate multiple times, it doesn't count toward this.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, shout out to them. We have some other like kind of bummer news that we'll talk about in the know. But I'm just like, I mean, I don't know. I'm proud of Bernie and I love Bernie, right? But I'm like, are they gonna now nominate him the DNC after they did him so dirty last time, and he potentially lose to Trump? Like that would suck.
Yeah, I saw a clip on him because, you know, he went on Fox News. And I think where he has the biggest support is with healthcare. And so, like, in the crowd, he was like, how many of you guys have insurance through your employers? And, like, everyone raised their hand. And he's like, how many of you guys would like state-funded insurance? And, like, everyone raised their hands. And so it was just kind of like – and it's like, you know, Fox is going to put – Fox supporting audience, because the whole point is I think they're trying to embarrass or make it hard for Bernie Sanders. So I think like it's I don't know anyone who's like, I don't really care about my insurance, regardless of what political party. So I think that he's smart in saying like, this is how I'm going to reach the people who might vote for me. And I have noticed he's like kind of shying away from the whole immigration thing, being like, I don't support open borders. And so I think that I don't know. I'm starting to believe more that, you know, let's see who he would choose as a running mate. But I think that he could get if he's continued to be smart about.
Yeah, he's got to be strategic.
Yeah, getting the people who what would make people go away from Trump. And that's saying, I will make sure you don't get your health care taken away.
Yeah, because ultimately, like, all the right was trying to do is frame him as a socialist. And, you know, like, conservatives are like, oh, my God, definitely not. And so he, I think, is picking up on that, or someone on his campaign is like, yo, tone it down.
Yeah.
You know, you can still be passionate about the things that you're passionate about. You aren't lying. It's just about what you publicize, what you talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's smart for going on Fox News. I think so. I think he handled himself well. So, yeah, shout out to Bernie. He's definitely, like, you know, doing better than I thought. Like, it doesn't seem hopeless. Yeah. And I don't want it to seem hopeless, because I want someone to beat Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that wraps up our shout-out segment, and now we will move on to our In the Know segment.
Yes.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Okay, so now for our In the Know segment.
Yes, and so our first In the Know topic is about Trump and his newest victim, who he has chosen to target, which is Representative Ilhan Omar. And so on Friday, so last week, he tweeted out a video that kind of distorts and takes out of context a clip of Omar speaking about 9/11 during a speech. And she says, she was talking about the rise of anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States. And so she says the phrase, because some people did something. And Trump took that phrase and then made a video that he tweeted with her just repeating that phrase and then cutting to the Twin Towers falling. And so they're like, some people did something, question mark, we will never forget. So kind of making it seem like she doesn't care about 9/11 and she is disrespectful and insensitive. And so, of course, because the president tweeted this, it reached millions of people. And so Omar stated that since the president's tweet, and this is a statement that she put out, quote, I have experienced an increase in direct threats on my life, many directly referencing or replying the president's video. I think the Capitol Police, the FBI, the House Sergeant at Arms, and the Speaker of the House for their attention to these threats. She argued that Trump is encouraging right-wing extremist violence, something which the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, of course, denied. And then in addition to the fact that she's being bullied by this, you know, very powerful person on Twitter, there has been criticism from the Democrat, from others in the Democratic Party, because the Democrats didn't really rush to her aid. It wasn't until some people started condoning and saying, like, this is wrong, that, you know, we got people like from the Democratic Party kind of saying, you know, this is wrong, she shouldn't be targeted. But it was very disappointing to see how they kind of left her out to dry for a little bit until they got media attention and they were like, oh, we should pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, I think it reinforces Trump's hate for women of color, or like, there's no other way but hate. I really do think he hates when women of color, like, if you see who he targets and who Fox targets and who the conservatives like Sean Hannity and Alex Jones target, when they target women of color, it is very aggressive. Mm-hmm. And it's not with the same energy that we target men, white men, or white women who say like terrible, terrible things.
Yeah, or even Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. There were good and bad people
on
both sides.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like talking about Nazis.
Yeah.
So if this ain't the pot, call in the kettle black. And he is strategic in that language. That wasn't unintentional.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Yeah. And then people started tweeting about how there was apparently evidence that Trump took economic advantage of 9/11 like survivors and stuff. Mm. And so they were just kind of saying, and then people who were associated with 9/11 coming to her defense and saying, like, this is too far. Like, this is, and it's what's disgusting is, like, he is exploiting a very terrible event. Like, no matter how you feel about it, conspiracy theory or not, like, he's exploiting something that we know damn well he doesn't give a shit about to kind of paint this woman as a
space.
Yeah, like as a terrible person. And all she was saying is people like me are attacked because there are other people who do things. And that's exactly what white people say, like, oh, just because a few white, you know, men, you know, blow up things doesn't mean we all like that. Just because a few bad apples in the police do this doesn't mean all police are bad. But it's like when we say that, we're, you know, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It was just, it was hard to watch that and to watch her. And then to know that they, you know, she had death threats from a tweet. Mm-hmm. Like, that's insane. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hopefully, you know, she stays safe. And to all people of the Muslim community, like, there's research that shows that if the group that you're a member of is targeted, that you feel like also in a part targeted as well. And so we definitely have to, you know, protect and keep an eye out for our Muslim brothers and sisters, because this is definitely like scary, especially like if
especially
people are
being instigated.
If people are willing to say, I'm going to kill you for saying some people. Like, I can't, like, it's just scary, so.
And then, too, if you felt that her statement was minimizing, you know, that catastrophe, your response is to then threaten her life.
Yeah.
So more death, that's your response?
Or, like, not come out and be like, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to. It's like, he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's probably, like, really okay with it.
Yeah. No, he is.
Yeah.
I'm sure he thinks it's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like the whole video that, what's with him in these videos? Who's making these videos for
him? I know.
It's not him. Like the whole Joe Biden video. Like
He has someone, he must have someone on his team that makes this.
Yeah, a teenager. Okay, so moving on to our next.
Yeah, and so our next story is a little lighter, but still fucked up. In the recent episode of Shark Tank, I used to watch it a lot, but then I got a little burned out on it because I started getting, like, my partner and I started getting too serious about it. Well, we were like, let's invent something.
You should.
Now, I don't have time for that. So,
oh my God, you totally could.
So, and then we'd get mad because we'd be like, that invention is getting, like, my partner is so mad about that sponge. It's like one of their best-selling products is like this, like, sponge that is just, it's a
is
real
it with the smiley face.
Yes.
Oh, I bought that.
Yeah, everyone's buying it.
Yeah, I like it. But yeah,
but it's such a simple
engineer.
I know, that's why he's like we could invent something. Anyway, so there is a recent pitch from Curl Mix Hair Products. The video was going viral, but as I was talking to Ebony about it while we were preparing for this episode, I can't find it anymore.
I'm sure they took it down.
Ebony thinks that they took it down.
No,
but it's like not on Instagram
sure
or Facebook, and I just saw it like an hour ago. It's crazy.
I'm sure that they did. Because, I mean, how often do you see Shark Tank clips on social media?
Yeah, they probably told them that it was copyright infringement. That's crazy. I mean, it got a lot of negative backlash, and this is why.
They should just keep – well, no, they'll probably block their page. I was going to say they should just keep reposting
that's
it
true.
Until –
Yeah, and they're getting a lot of traction based on what happened. Mm-hmm. So the pitch for Curl Mix, a hair product created by two black business owners, went viral due to the responses it got from the sharks. So in this particular episode, there was a woman named Ali Webb, who is the owner of Dry Bar, which is like a hair thing. Mm-hmm. So she's like a hair – she made her money off hair. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, people were like, oh, well, this is a hair product. She's going to want to invest in this because she knows hair. But, like, the reaction from the sharks were just kind of, like, confusion and ignorance. So Ali Webb said that, quote, unquote, that she wasn't really interested in this company or investing in this company because she was, quote, not in the curly hair business, but in the business of making curly hair straight, which is hilarious because for that episode, her hair was curly. Like, she had, like, curled it.
Yeah.
And then Mark Cuban said he, quote unquote, had no clue what they were talking about. And sometimes they do that where they're like, sorry, I can't invest. This isn't my wheelhouse. And it's like, I don't know. And I think it's really convenient. And they used to do this a lot with products tailored towards women. The men would be like, oh, this isn't my wheelhouse. This isn't
you
what I do.
You step outside of your wheelhouse all the time.
I know. And it's like, yeah. And so it's like, oh, Mark Cuban, you play professional basketball. Like, that's why you invest. You're the owner of a basketball team because you yourself. But anyway, So I went on the social media because they made two posts on their Instagram and on their Facebook saying that they got an offer by one of the sharks, but it definitely like devalued their company. Mm-hmm. And they said that they were disappointed in the reaction that they got from the sharks and disappointed that their hair product was misunderstood because they had a lot of good sales. You know, the profit margins were so large. They were making so much money and paying so little. And they said that they were running out of product. So this seems like a really great investment. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people online were saying, and especially a lot of people of color were saying that this is not surprising because this is what happens when they assume, they devalue the black dollar. So kind of an assumption of, oh, this isn't going to be that important or that profitable because it's targeted for quote unquote, like a certain market. A niche market. Yeah. And a lot of people were saying if they were smart, they would know that black women spend a lot of money on their hair products. Yeah. And then they were pointing out to other things and they were like, you know, in Europe, you know, in the UK, they know that a lot of Indian people spend a lot of money on the hair products. Mm-hmm. And so they don't just ignore that. And they were saying that that's just kind of hilarious for the sharks who are supposed to be business savvy to be like kind of ignorant. And then other people pointed out that although this is, you know, this was more tailored for, I guess, like the African-American or black community, that there are people who aren't black who also have curly hair and would use this product. So they weren't saying like, hey, this is only for black people. They were just saying this works well for this type of hair, but also like anyone would be able to use it. Mm-hmm. And then other people were kind of saying like this reinforces the whole Eurocentric mm-hmm. Beauty ideals of like straight hair is what we need to want to have. And like, so my hair is curly, and I definitely feel that a lot of times, like when I would, like for events or stuff, like when you see pictures of things, people always have their hair like not curly, like curly haired doesn't seem like, I don't know. It just seems like it's portrayed as like, this is what you do when you're lazy and don't want to do anything with your hair. Or this is what you do when you're just going out. But for formal events, you're going to like, you know, straighten your hair and do that. And I didn't really think about it until the response of this video when I was like, you know, I think that, you know, it seems like it's just about hair, but it's bigger than that. It's mm-hmm. about how businesses from people of color who target or are inclusive of people of color are kind of dismissed. And I think we'll circle back to our diversity thing, but it seems like one of the producers were like, oh, this would look good. You know, a black-owned business mm-hmm. would look good as a pitch, but yet it just fell flat. And it was just like, I don't see this type of ignorance. I've seen a lot of stupid products on there, like a lot of stupid products. And I've seen sharks invest with them enthusiastically and not be like, oh, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
So
like those stupid Hallmark cards. Like, I think that I mean, like, as nice as I think that they are, like, the amount of money that they were willing to invest in that was crazy. And then, I mean, they also have a history of being kind of problematic when it comes to you know, black women, particularly beauty and cosmetics, they told, would you say that the lip bar?
Yeah.
And they told them that they looked like colorful cockroaches.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how do you think that is okay to say?
And they just opened a store. And so it's.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes, well, I think that, you know, like you're saying, like you have to be pretty far, and for investors, for business owners, it seems like they're dropping the ball by being so uninformed about black women and the beauty industry.
Yeah.
Like, and how much money they spend.
Yeah.
In it,
or assuming that there won't be enough. Like, if I don't know anything, I'm just going to assume that black women probably don't have, or this isn't going to be profitable enough for me to invest without knowing that, you know. And they even brought up, like, what's her name, Madam C.J. Walker, mm-hmm. about, they're like, you know, if you knew your history, you would know that, like, you know, she became a millionaire in like the 1800s off of her hair product. Yeah. And so if you, the woman who made her living off hair should at least know that, or at least have a better response. Like, I already have something in this, so yeah. I'm not going to compete with myself. But for her to say, I'm in the making curly hair straight business is so, I think, is so ignorant and stupid. So yeah. Definitely, you know, look them up on Instagram and Facebook, because I looked at a lot of their comments and everyone had good things to say about like how well it worked for their hair. Yeah. So, you know, we want to support, you know, people who, and I liked that they kind of like stood, you know, made a stand by posting about it and not just, you know, being mad about it, but saying like, well, we don't care what they think. We care what you think. So let us know.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a very clear example of how diversity could benefit.
Yeah. The Shark Tank.
Yeah, like, because, I mean, it's if you had one black woman up there, she could have easily.
Yeah, and their resident black guy wasn't there.
Oh,
Damon.
Where was he?
I don't know. He was, he wasn't there that. So
yeah,
people were like, where's Damon?
Yeah, he could have told him.
Yeah.
He could have been like, well, I don't know if he's married to a black woman, but if he is, he could have been like, or if he has black daughters or whatever, or a mother, like. Could have just been like,
I mean, even white women, like you guys, everyone, Mexican women, everyone spends. So I spend like $50 on one bottle of shampoo, and I would spend that much for my hair. You don't have to be whatever race to understand that people from whatever.
They act like you do. Okay, so now moving on to our next story. So we talked about the Democratic candidates and how much they have raised, and we gave them shout outs for that. Obviously, you know how we feel about Trump on this podcast, so he is not in the shout-out segment.
Yeah.
But he apparently, his campaign has raised, or his re-election campaign has raised $30 million now. And this is within the first 3 months of that campaign launching. He was receiving $34 donations on average, which means that almost 900,000 people are still invested in this man.
Am I cynical to think that he is somehow? Are these numbers valid?
How could he do
that? These numbers valid, or is he?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's being reported. I don't know if he maybe
is making contributions. See, this is how cynical I am. He has people's information and is making contributions with his money on his behalf.
Oh, that'd be crazy.
But that's how cynical I am.
I mean, maybe. I would like to hope, because this is, I mean, $30 million. So that puts him $12 million over.
But you know what? People are. I also know that people are still super invested in him.
Yeah.
And what he has
to say.
Which
is like, I mean, I was like, oh, you know, $30 million. Like maybe he's getting some, you know, corporate donations that are $100,000. Nope. $34 donations are the average. And I mean, I guess we need to think about, like, is that the mean or the median?
Yeah.
You know? But I guess just with this, with the numbers that we have, like, this is terrifying.
It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, I mean, that's bad news.
Okay, let's
You
be
definitely
positive.
Gave me some
let's
bad
be
news
positive,
right now.
And say that.
I'm just going to stick to my conspiracy theory that this is his money.
Hopefully. Hopefully the good old boys are paying as much. I mean, I don't know what.
But just because he has all this money doesn't mean he's going to win.
Yeah, that's true. But I wonder what the GOP rules are for the debates.
Probably none.
Because, you know, like for the DNC, they have to have unique donors.
Yeah.
And so for him, it could be like, so what you're saying, what you're suggesting could be the case if he's not required to have unique donors. And there could just be one person that's donating.
Or maybe every Trump employee is donating on his behalf.
That could be.
That's. I wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you watch his?
I don't watch anything he does now.
Last time.
Oh, his debates. Yes, yeah, to make fun of him.
Yeah, and how were they? Like, I just don't understand how he
use his GIFs from his debates.
I love the
to
GIFs.
Send to people GIFs. Because they are like so ridiculous. Yeah. Like, he was so ridiculous that that's why everyone thought Hillary was going to win.
Yeah.
Because he's a moron.
Yeah. Yeah, I still can't believe it till this day. Like, someone who can hardly form coherent sentences.
Yeah.
How could he have debated anyone and won? enough to be, well, in a convincing enough way that people would elect him. Like, I don't know. Anyways. Okay, so our last story is about a surveillance video that recently, I guess, was put out. And it shows Chicago police officers punching and dragging a 16-year-old high school student down the stairs. So it was released last week, and it, I guess they punched her, drug her down the stairs, and tased her. It was obtained by BuzzFeed News, and it contradicts,
of course,
the officer's previous statements that the student, and her name is...
Denigma Howard. That's how I would pronounce it.
And it's, they claimed that she initiated the violence,
of
and
course.
This was back in January, on January 29th. But they say that she initiated the violent encounter at Marshall High School and that her actions caused the three of them to fall down the stairs together. But in the video, Howard appears to speak to the two officers, who are Johnny Pierre and Sherry Tripp. And as she begins to walk away, one of the officers grabs her and wrestles her down the stairs, with the other officer following behind. About 20 seconds later, one of the officers is captured dragging her by her wrist down the bottom of the stairs, and the other officer is on top of her. And so she was initially charged with two felony counts of aggravated battery in connection with the incident based solely on their statements. But after the video has been published, the charges were dropped.
And then Chicago is just recently being like,
they're having so much.
And they were just recently like, you need to apologize. Jussie Smollett needs to apologize to the city of Chicago. It's like, if we make a list of the people the city of Chicago has to apologize to, then we would be here forever.
Yo,
it's like, let's focus on
that. They are wilding right now. Like, I don't understand.
I mean, that's.
How do two adults, one a man, wait, is Sherry Tripp a man? Is that a
woman? I assume Sherry Tripp was a woman. I haven't seen the I haven't seen this video.
Yeah,
I don't think I could watch it. I don't think I could watch someone getting a 16-year-old girl getting punched.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do that.
But it's like, you're a grown man. How do you feel comfortable dragging someone's child down the stairs and punching her and tasing her?
Yeah.
All because she said something you didn't like?
Yeah.
Like, why do people act like, and it's like, it's so baffling to me, because when it's people of color, it's like, oh my God, you're so disrespectful to the police. How could you have said that to them? As though they aren't human beings. Meanwhile, who was the guy yesterday that they arrested, and he was wearing like a bulletproof like armor vest and carrying like some crazy military weapon, and they weren't fearful for their life. They managed to arrest him. Who was that guy, actually? Let me, because I almost put it in here, but I was like, I don't want too much like police bashing shit, because I just don't feel like being on that. But what?
I mean, I've seen videos of people who, you know, white people or white boys who say like really disrespectful things to cops and don't get tased.
Yeah. So, yeah, so a white guy wearing body armor and carrying a loaded gun arrested in Chicago train station.
Same city.
Same city.
And I bet you he wasn't 16. Oh, let's see his mugshot.
He's 21. Look at him. Look at him. He was carrying a 9mm pistol and wearing a bulletproof vest and had a duffel bag filled with SWAT equipment.
That's crazy.
How? How? And he's only being held on a $100,000 bond.
I mean, it's, we live in different countries. Like, we really do. We live in two different countries,
and
we're treated.
He has the nerve to look sad. Like, you're an idiot.
We're treated differently because of our skin color. And I think that you time and time again, we have these incidents when we tell someone, like, it, no matter the color, it is never okay to punch someone who is six, you know, to punch a 16-year-old. Even if you're saying you're disrespectful to the police, yeah, but does that warrant punching someone? Mm-hmm. Like, one person can't be, I don't know, you don't have the training and the capacity to restrain someone without punching, you know, dragging them down the stairs and then tasering them.
A child, like, you, there's... Yeah, I don't know. There's zero empathy. Like, I think that
that's terrible and traumatizing for that person.
Yes, and traumatizing. I mean, not just for her, but like the people that she was in school.
Yeah.
You know, so you have a bunch of like other high school kids around watching this happen. And it's like, but in this is like one of several incidences over
incidents.
Several incidents over the past few years where, like black teenage girls have been
manhandled
by police.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like they just I don't know. It's really crazy to me. But yeah. So a hearty fuck you to them. And we will move on to the What's Being Slept On segment.
So I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
Okay, so now for our What's Being Slept On segment. So the topic is the thin line between diversity and tokenism.
Yes.
And Zelma had suggested that we discuss this in light of the whole Shark Tank incident. Yeah. And was there some...
So I was like filming for something that I can't share specifically what for. But I will soon-ish. But I was filming something and it took place at a school because they were using the school as like a background for what I was filming for. And a black student came up and was like, oh, what is this for? And jokingly, he was like, is this a diversity video? And I think like a part of him was like, it was a joke, but I think he was serious. Yeah, he was just kind of like, this would make sense. Mm-hmm. And I was telling Emily that at that moment, I was just kind of like, it's funny because I think we people of color who are in, and you don't have to be in mostly white spaces. I mean, America technically is a mostly white space. But we know that, you know, right now it's like kind of well accepted that diversity is in.
Yo,
like,
I'm putting that on a shirt.
What?
Do you want one?
What?
America, it's a mostly predominantly white institution.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I want one.
Yeah.
And so I just, I don't know. I feel like people of color in mostly white spaces, which is a lot of us, but like in really like 24/7 mostly white spaces, we know that diversity, especially in academia, but maybe like I think now more so like in corporations and Hollywood, there's this big push for, you know, including diverse voices. We tell you all the time and are in the know about companies who get in trouble for lack of diversity because they say they do some really offensive shit, and had they had more diverse people on staff, they would know, you know, better. But we also know that there's also, that doesn't always mean that we have the ability to be able to make a difference or to have our voices really heard or to not just be a pretty face on a brochure, mm-hmm. to be like, hey, come to our school because we care about people of color. But once you get here, you're done. And so I felt like that really prompted me to want to talk about this because I, for what I do, and I mean, in part of this filming, I had to talk about my story. And whenever I talk about my story, about my background, about what I've had to overcome to go to the school that I go to, which is considered an elite university, and to like be getting a PhD, which is one of the highest degrees you can get, I always feel like I'm selling myself kind of like to white people sometimes. Like, this is my story. But like even when I was filming, someone asked me, because they had extras who were playing parts and they were reenacting things from my life. And someone was like, oh, are you an actress? Because they thought I was like a hired person and we were just doing this movie about this person. And I was like, no, this is about me. This is my life. And they're like, this is real? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like part of the reason why I'm in this project is because of how compelling my story is. Mm-hmm. But Is it because people are like, oh, this is a sobber, this will sell? Or is it because people are like, wow, that's really inspiring? And the fact that I know that it's both kind of gets me sometimes. And I don't always want it to feel that way. But I guess like with the line between diversity and tokenism, I've been a token a lot of times. And yeah, it's just kind of hard to separate for myself. When is the diversity I bring meaningful? And when is it just like, I'm just here for show?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, one thing that I think is interesting is that I think for the most part, there is an assumption that people of color have stories like yours.
Yeah.
That like, this is the, you know, this is kind of the stereotypical minority experience. Mm-hmm. And so when they hear about people growing up poor or growing up whatever, it's like, oh, okay, that's what I had assumed.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah.
And so, but I mean, it's, I don't know. I think that it's difficult because it's kind of, it benefits us.
Yeah,
you know, to a large extent, but it also benefits the institution.
Yeah, yeah.
And so by, like, for instance, like, for us being here, it benefits the department mm-hmm. because, and the university, because they can show, like, hey, look at how diverse our department is. Look how diverse our university is. We have students of color, and not only are they students of color, but they come from these impoverished backgrounds, mm-hmm. and we are, like, lifting people out of poverty. But then we also get PhDs. And it's not like we are being handed something that we didn't work for, that we didn't earn, but it's also knowing that the reason why they prioritized having us here is because it looks good on paper. And also considering the fact that, you know, like we were, like our cohort for the students of color, mm-hmm. right? And so it's, and then it's, because we also, so one thing that happened recently is that our department put out a kind of, I don't know, what should we call it?
It was an ad.
Just about, because
we're trying to expand our program.
Yeah, and they put out an ad and they strategically put up, like, you know, we have
the, like, the most diverse people in our department.
Looking, and so
diverse looking. Yes.
And so it's like it gives you the illusion that, I mean, granted, so we have like, well, now we have like three black girls, and then we have one woman who is Muslim.
Yes.
And they put, well, one of them wears a headdress, hijab, and they put her on the cover of that. And then one of the other black women, she has locks, put her on the cover of that.
I didn't even pick that up.
Yeah. And some others that are kind of racially ambiguous looking. And so they're using that to pull in, you know, other students of color to give the illusion that there is this diversity. Now, whether or not that doesn't speak to the climate of the department and like what it actually like, is it an inclusive space? Mm-hmm. Like that is kind of taken for granted, you know, because I think, I mean, when I started the program, I was one of two black girls in the program and the other was in my cohort. And so I think that
I was like, who's the other?
Yeah, like I think that when they, you know, they're strategic about those kinds of things because, I mean, for me, the only reason that I applied to this program was because of the one black faculty person. And I did not apply for grad programs that did not have faculty of color. Like, I was like, no, like, I'm not going to be, I mean, that would be an uncomfortable, because it's so intimate. Like,
I just assumed I would always be uncomfortable, so that wasn't even on my radar.
No, I can't do it. Especially in a sociology program where I'm studying inequality. Like, to have to sit in a class and be the only black student while you're sitting there and talking about poverty and how deviant black people are and black culture is, like, I can't, no, it's too much. But yeah, and so then they put you on the website so that when other students apply, they see black faces and it's like, oh, okay. So they, you know, there are black people.
Yeah,
I can fit. But then you get there and it's like a little bit of a different story.
It just makes it seem like our school is mostly minority when that's not the case. And it's like, even if our department is, I think our department does a better job than most departments about making sure that diversity is a priority, because I see a lot of other departments and like it's all one like race.
Yeah.
And so I do have to give props to our department for actually having a diverse cohort people. But I also think that that is not reflective of the fact that, yeah, but it's a small department in a larger institution that is mostly white serving. And so, and that really, I mean, I don't know if you saw the video of the undergrad in Columbia University who was a black guy who got arrested. He got like manhandled by cops because they didn't believe he went there and he had to show them his ID. And it's like that's what happens when you have students of color. Even at elite universities, you're still you have to see and know that that's a reality for you, that you people. And I know when I walk around campus, people don't think I go here. Like and I guess that's part of the and me saying I know maybe like the whole imposter syndrome of people, but so many times people's response to like surprise that I go here is what triggers me to think that, you know, that's why I go. And we have a lot of stuff at my house, and like when people assume that we wear stuff, and when people assume that I'm not wearing it because I go there, it's like really frustrating. Or that I'm wearing it because my partner went there is really frustrating. And that's the kind of things that that's what happens when you're a diverse person. Like when you're the part of the diversity at a mostly, you know, non-diverse place. So we're here for the diversity in one area, but then I'm spending my time in this other area, and in this other space is where I'm feeling all these feelings of I don't belong and I'm uncomfortable. And so I think that in the line between diversity and tokenism, there's a line for the individual themselves of in some spaces I do bring diversity. And I feel like with my research group, my diversity is meaningful. Like people, like with my advisor, like she listens to my perspective and what I bring. But when I am at a conference, my diversity is meaningless. And I feel that the questions that I bring up about to kind of challenge the way, even the phrasing that people use, it's always like, that's not really important. What do you think about the analysis? And so it's just kind of like, you know, I think that the line between diversity and tokenism for me, it's that I'm both in different places.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I remember during our first year, someone told me that while they were walking on campus, heard, because our university is in a residential neighborhood. And so there are a lot of people that live in the residential neighborhood that come on campus to walk or jog or walk their dogs or whatever. And so someone said there are two white women walking, and they were older, and one turns to the other and it's like, oh, I didn't know they were letting niggers in here.
this wasn't
me, but
oh my god.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, I don't, also to mention, like the residential neighborhood is like super duper duper like high income, you
yeah
know?
Yeah,
like,
it's these one are of like, the wealthiest neighborhoods in the country.
Yeah, so these are like multi-million dollar homes and everything, you know. So and then also that's like crazy. They've only, like, black people have only been going to this university for 50 years.
Yeah,
so, well, not going to university, but that's when they started allowing them to come.
Because black people weren't allowed at our university. Universities,
yeah, it was like written into, you know, the mission. But yeah, and so I could see that would be surprising to them. You know, you walk around campus and I'm not walking around campus and seeing black students. Like, that's not.
Yeah. You know, so I think that speaks to the small number. I mean, we're so small that there's a specific group in our university for PhDs of color.
Yeah.
And we can all fit in a table in like a classroom. Like that's how, and it's like all PhDs, like in every engineering, math, statistics. It's like, imagine thinking of, I think actually, so in sociology, Ebony right now, no, when Ebony graduates, she will be the first black woman to graduate with a PhD in sociology at our university.
In sociology.
Yeah. At a university.
In sociology, like, we literally study
race.
Yeah. We literally study, like, all these different axes of, you know, axes of difference, inequality, like all of these things, and then we reproduce it.
Yeah. And that's like the line between diversity and tokenism, because
It's crazy because when you think about it, somebody has to be the first, right?
Yeah, yeah. But in 2019,
yeah, yeah.
That's what.
And it's like, you know, because and I'm always conflicted because, you know, you want more minorities in these spaces, but you also want it to be, like you said, meaningful.
Yeah.
You don't want it to just be like, oh, God, like our department or our company or our whatever is too white, so let's get a couple of brown faces in here. No, like it, you have to recognize the shortcomings. You have to recognize what it is that diversifying your employee pool is bringing. Like
yeah.
what benefit, what value is that bringing? And I think also not to the extent that it's just like, oh, you know, you speak for all black people. What is it that black people think? Or you speak for everyone who is Mexican, or even worse, everyone who's Latino.
Like, yeah, because yeah. it's so much. No, I remember one time I was in a class and we were talking about what I chose to look at was the neighborhood that I grew up in and the neighborhood and another neighborhood. And I was comparing the life expectancies, and it was terrible.
Yeah.
And while I was giving this presentation, I started crying. And this is me at 20, like I was 28 at the time, but a 28-year-old like crying in front of students, I wasn't prepared. I did not, I swear when I was doing all this, it wasn't emotional at all.
Yeah.
But in giving the presentation and in looking at the slide and those numbers and seeing the difference, I started crying. And then I remember that one of my friends who was in the class told me that the professor told her that he like it would never occur to him that I would be taking like things so personal. And he didn't mean it in like yeah. I know he didn't, knowing who he is, he didn't mean it in a like an insensitive way, mm-hmm. but it's just kind of like when your institution isn't, another issue with the diversity is like, are you prepared for what diversity brings? Because like they just hadn't had
no,
they just don't have that. So they weren't aware of like what happens when you place people who have actually experienced what you're studying into the space when you're studying it. And so the fact that he just was like, it was super uncomfortable. It was super uncomfortable for me. There was no like debriefing afterwards. He did not email me, which I appreciate because I don't know how I would have, like, I would have lied anyway and been like, I'm okay.
Yeah.
But it's just like, and there have been a lot of instances like that in my career where I've had to cry after a talk, after a presentation, after a conference, after an interaction because of how it made me feel, knowing that I, you know, at least I'm here to check people and be like, well, you say these things about this group of people. I actually am from that group, and I haven't experienced that. What do you think about this? But then the amount of labor it takes to challenge someone to be like, one, I have to out myself and to be like, okay, so my family's been deported. Let me now tell everyone who I don't know that my family's been deported. Let me rehash that deportation experience all in order to, you know, kind of challenge the way that you're talking about this group. So I also feel like in the line between diversity and tokenism is like, is that space prepared for the diversity? And if it's not, then it's just maybe a space of tokenism.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and I think that that can be the case regardless of how many, like what the quantifiable number, like what, you know, because it's like it's like the difference between like quantity and quality. It's like if you now my thing and what I was telling Zelma before we started recording is that I think that if you're going to have a quote-unquote diversity hire, having one is just as bad as having none.
Yeah,
because that is such an isolating experience.
Yeah, and too much pressure.
Yeah, and you have everybody looking at you like, oh, you're the person that was hired to fill like this diversity shortage that we had, you know. And I mean, and then the experiences of like, you know, maybe not having someone that looks like you, maybe they don't have the exact same experience, but there is some relatability there. There is some kind of, there's some level of understanding. Like if I'm in a all white space and I see another like black person, it's kind of like an instant like,
yeah,
okay. Like if any weird stuff pops off, like we got each other, there's some kind of connection. Or
yeah.
like I may have, if it just so happens that I'm eating lunch by myself, I can talk to that person.
Yeah.
Like it's like an unspoken kind of connection.
Yeah.
And if you are the only one and there is a culture of whiteness and you are there to infiltrate it, then you, it's like you're a lone ranger. I don't even.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's in I, okay, like, and I don't know what the demographic is for our listeners. And so I don't, I've been like trying not to offend anyone, but also just imagine if it were an all black company and then they hired one white person like that.
Yeah.
Just picture it. You can't, it, you
I mean,
can't even
people,
really picture
I always go back to gender because people can really understand gender. Mm-hmm. How mad people get when they see pictures of the Trump administration and they're like, look at all these men.
Yeah.
Or when they look at, you know, Hollywood stuff and they're like, look at all these men.
Only one woman.
People can point to that and be like, that's terrible.
That's awful.
That
has to be so isolating.
That must be so hard for her. Oh, my gosh.
I can't imagine the kind of stuff, the kind of things that those guys talk about.
Yeah.
And then she has to just.
Yeah.
Be there and listen.
And so imagine that, but like with race.
Yeah.
And then add women to women of color to the race and the gender.
There's just too many things. There's too many things, you know? And so okay, so one of the questions I wanted to ask is like what the benefit of diversity is, right? And so we initially it was like the way that diversity was framed is that, you know, you need to bring in people that come from under-resourced backgrounds that don't have as many opportunities and who have kind of gotten the short end of the stick when it comes to because a lot of hires happen like within networks. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of people are hired because their dad knew somebody that was hiring or their dad's friend or so on, you know, and not necessarily on paper applications. So there are people that, like, if you are not within that network of people with social capital, then you lose out because nobody's reviewing your application.
Yeah.
So the benefit of diversity is that it kind of puts to bed that method of hiring exclusively within networks and forcing, you know, folks to look beyond their networks to hire. And then it kind of flipped to like diversity also benefits the people, like the majority group, because it exposes them to more cultures, like other cultures and stuff, and like makes them more tolerant and, mm-hmm. you know, all of this stuff, which will bleed out to society itself. And then over time, we'll get rid of racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now that we have, I mean, I don't necessarily doubt that that could potentially be the case, but you have to, well, one, there has to be interaction, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times there's diversity, but there's no
interaction.
There's no, interaction across groups. And so it's like, no, you're not, that person's not becoming more, or that group is not becoming more tolerant because they aren't even interacting with the minority. So yeah, I'm like wondering now, like what the benefit of diversity is. Is it still those things or like, is there anything else beyond that? Like why, beyond just like, you know, this is morally right, what's the incentive?
I don't know. And I think that's why I wanted to talk about it, because it's just kind of like, other than what they feed us, which is like, this will work. You know, it bleeds out. It's like, we don't even think about that. That we don't think that's true in economics anymore. Trickle down, that you just, you know, if the top is doing well, it'll trickle down. We're not believing in that anymore. So I believe less and less in, like, if you're sprinkle in a few brown and black people, then people will be, you know, because what we see is with increased immigrants and increased people of color, there's increased hostility and hate crimes.
Yeah.
So I don't know necessarily if that is an avenue, if, like, diversity is an avenue. It's more of unlearning, you know, toxic shit.
Yeah.
And that is a more active approach than also and then this also places it on the people of color being like, you know, just make friends with them. Just go in there, you know, put yourself at risk, you know, it'll be uncomfortable for you, but it's good for them. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, like they have to do stuff too. So I don't know. I do think there's a benefit of diversity because it does bring different perspectives, no matter if it's a diversity of race, of class, of gender, of sexual orientation. But I just don't know if a lot of current systems are set up in a way that makes it meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, because like I was saying earlier, I think that it is beneficial for like us, right?
Yeah.
To you know, we want PhDs. Like, it's good. It'll I think it trickles out in that way, in the way that we may be motivating or encouraging, like, people within, you know, like, our mm-hmm. families and friends and stuff like that. But beyond that, I don't know. I mean, beyond, like, increasing the number of Black and brown people with PhDs.
Yeah.
What? Because so my next question was going to be, like, what could the potential costs or drawbacks be? And I think that the amount of distress and strain that it puts on the minorities or the, you know, the diverse hires or the tokens in that situation, like, I don't know if that is a fair trade.
Yeah, no, it's not.
You know, because it's, I mean, again, like, our program is, I think, best case scenario.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of improvements that need to be made.
Yeah.
And so I can only imagine what people are like, what people are feeling in more traditional programs that are, because also another thing about our program is that it's predominantly women. And so other programs would be male dominant, mostly white. And to be a woman of color in that space, like, I just can't imagine what that experience is like.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be so. And then, I mean, getting through grad school is already, like,
stressful.
Yeah. And so it's like, on top of that, you also are experiencing this, like, I don't even know what to call it besides, like, isolation.
Yeah, distress.
Yeah, distress. Probably, like, just daily, like, on a daily basis, just, like, drowning in microaggressions. Like,
yeah, being uncomfortable. Like, just adapting to uncomfortableness, like, a constant state of discomfort.
Yeah, because, like, even if people, and it's not even, like, people are not always intentionally offensive. Like, sometimes you just get dumb questions.
Yeah.
And it just makes you feel like there are so many times where I'm like, oh, I want to, you know, braid my hair in this way or that way. And it's like, you know, this is a small thing, but I don't want to stand out. Like, I already stand out. I don't want to stand out more. Like, I don't want to be on top of being the Black girl. Oh, the Black girl with whatever hair, you know, because they, like, the women in, I mean, the white women in the department always have comments. And it's like, I get it. It's sometimes, most of the time, they're complimentary, but no, just leave me alone. Like, just leave me alone. Like, I'm not asking for your comment. I don't need you to tell me how big my hair is. Just leave me alone. Let me mind my business, you know? And it's after a while of that, it's like, I want to not spend time around y'all because I want to just, you know, exist in my own little space. I want to be able to dictate, like, who comments about my, like, appearance or not. Like, just don't comment on it. I don't comment on yours. I might say that your outfit's cute, but I'm not like, oh, shoot, got your roots done. Like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, I'm letting you live. Like, I'm letting you live, and I'm minding my business, you know? And so I think that, you know, like, that, even though that was a pretty trivial example, like, there, I mean, I've had, like, and I think that because of, I think compartmentalizing is something that has helped me to get through, like, all the classes that we've taken, like, taking classes about race, taking class, and it's always like, oh, there go the Black people again, mm-hmm. like, at the bottom. Oh, and in another area, the Black people are at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Oh, and it doesn't matter how much education they have, the Black people are at the bottom. And it's like, after a while, it's just like, oh, my God, I'm so tired of hearing about this, you know?
The graphs where it's like, oh.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah. And then, oh, my God. So I don't think I told you about this, but we had some visiting scholars a couple weeks ago. And one of the women, so she's white. And for some reason, she just, I don't know why she feels like, and I don't think that she's, I actually don't know if she's doing it on purpose. If she were to tell me that, yeah, that was intentional, I would not be surprised. Because she would just be like, she was talking about a situation where she went to a restaurant and she ate and realized she had left her wallet at home. And they let her leave to go get it and trusted that she would come back to pay for it. And then she goes and, like, points at me and she's like, yeah, but, like, that wouldn't have worked if I was her color. This is our first time meeting. Like, I don't know this woman.
You don't have to say that.
Yeah, it's like, what? Like, everybody at this table. Yes, exactly. Everybody knows what white privilege is like.
Yeah.
You don't have to, like, come on now. We're smarter than that.
So I'm like, what do you mean?
Yeah, I was just like, okay. And then another friend, so my friend Ellen, who she's been on this podcast before, was, like, looking at me, like, kind of like, oh, my God. And then she, like, texts me after, like, are you okay? Like, I'm sorry about that. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, no, I mean, you got to shrug those things off. But it's just, like, that kind of stuff. Like, I know I'm black sitting here. You don't have to constantly. And then there was another situation with the same woman where she was trying to talk about, like, respectability politics, but she's also older, and so she was calling it something else. But she was doing a presentation, and this is like a presentation of her research. And so she is trying to explain what these processes are, and the audience wasn't understanding it. And so she was like, can you help me out? You know what I'm talking about.
She's Louise.
And I was like, do I know? And she was like, yeah, you know. And I felt pressure to...
Don't all of you know?
I felt pressure to, like, you know, to chime in. But I was... But after, you know, reflecting, I'm always reflecting on, you know, like, how I should have made a snappier or more aggressive or passive, you know, like, passive-aggressive comment. But for some reason, I just go along with it, trying to be a good sport.
It's just easier. It's like, it exerts less energy and emotional labor to just... go with it. Then if we had to fight every microaggression that we encounter, then it would be like,
and then because people are so, like, quote unquote well-meaning, and they don't realize that they're offending you, how you respond, I think, because that's where, you know, you get a lot of the, like, you know, people are always talking about white tears and stuff like that, and it's because after microaggression after microaggression after microaggression, the minority in the situation gets frustrated and snaps and is like, don't fucking touch my hair again.
Yeah.
You know? And then the person on the other end of that is like, oh my God. Like,
you didn't have to talk to me that way.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm so tired of having to tell every person not to touch my hair. Like, no, like, I can't tell you how many times I've been at an amusement park in line and random people behind me will just put their hands in my hair.
That's crazy.
Like, I don't.
I couldn't imagine someone doing that.
Yeah, it's like, oh my, no, don't pet me. Like, I don't know. It's like after a while of that, like you have to learn to just, I think, especially if you're going to be in predominantly white spaces, like you have to, like, swallow it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'll just be cussing everybody out.
You'll just be
angry. And then you'll come off as angry. Mm-hmm. And it's like people don't realize that you have just... they've surpassed the threshold.
Yeah, for every one thing you're angry about, there were 20 other things
that you let go.
You let it slide. Yeah.
So, okay. So next question. What even counts as diversity?
I don't know. I feel like it's people just assume, like, color, but...
Have some color in there.
Yeah, but it's... I don't know. I feel like even... What people don't realize is even within racial ethnic groups, there's, like, so many differences by class and by age and by sexual orientation. And I think that one of the things you talked about is the one person having to talk to for everyone. They'll be like, brown person, you can talk for black people, for Asians, for – you're a woman too. Great. So if we get a woman of color, then you can not only talk for all races, but
don't
also
let her
for
be a
women.
Lesbian.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I feel like a lot of times people try to, like, be as efficient as they can with the diversity and be like, let's kill as many birds with one stone as we can and get, you know, if we can get a lesbian black woman.
Oh my gosh. And then, you know, the
boxes.
Yes, the disabilities, the veteran.
Yeah.
Like, just check off all those boxes.
Yeah. Then we have all these different groups that she can speak for.
Yeah. And then we can put her on the pamphlet in a military uniform. I'm joking. I don't know. I don't know if I even have any more to add.
Yeah, no. I think it's like a funny question, but it was, like, prompted kind of, like, truth in that, like, you know, I know that I count as diversity for an immigrant, for a woman, for a Latina. And sometimes it's just like I can't speak for all of them because all those three groups are already so diverse. Like my opinion is just my opinion. It's not every Latino person's experience or every immigrant person's experience or every woman's experience. But when you're the person who brings in the diversity, that's part of your role is like you count for everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's again, like, I do think that – okay, so I want to talk a little bit about how diversity can work, right? So I think that I – so I've had black students who, you know, were not younger than me, but, like I was more advanced than them in the program. And they, you know, would say things like, you inspire me, right? Or I'll talk to, like – I talk to, like, black undergrad students, and they're like, yo, you're in a PhD program. Like, you know, and it's inspiring for them. And so I think that it's beneficial for that reason. And I think that it can work effectively for that reason, because ultimately that's the goal, right, to get to make these spaces more equitable. But I think that where a lot of companies and stuff go wrong is that they assume that just by incorporating these people, everything is all right with the world. And it's like, no, you have to do work within your current company culture to make sure that it is a safe space for those people. And companies, institutions, they don't do enough work to make sure that that's the case.
Yeah.
They think that the hiring is the first and last step.
Yeah, like that's it.
Like, yeah, it's like, I've done my job.
Got him.
Done my job.
Collected my black.
Yeah.
But brown.
Yeah, what you find in a lot of these companies is that the attrition rates for these diversity hires is super high.
Yeah.
And they're leaving because they don't feel – it's not an inclusive space. And so if you want – it's not enough to hire if you can't keep them. Yeah, and so I think that my like one recommendation for sure would be to not just hire one.
Yeah.
Make sure you hire, I mean, maybe three, just in case, you know, two people don't really care for each other that much.
Well, and it's just like you would never just hire one white woman and be like, that's it.
Done.
We got our white woman. It's like, no, there's so much difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think there's that. I think that people are trying to do all this training and stuff, which research has found is ineffective, and it's ineffective because they bring someone in for like a 3-day crash course on like minority culture and like what diversity means and, you know, how not to be racist, how not to be sexist or classist or homophobic or whatever. But, you know, you definitely need kind of to assess that on a regular basis. You need to create, like, you know, maybe small groups, support groups, or not support groups, I forgot what they're called, but internal groups where people can have, like, I don't know, if you're at an engineering firm, like, women of color in engineering, or black women in engineering, or, you know, Mexican women in engineering, or whatever, mothers in engineering, kind of stuff, so that you're creating this, like, inclusive environment, and people feel like they matter.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think that's why we wanted to talk about this is because we personally experience it. Mm-hmm. But I know that a lot of people experience this. And it's not just a race thing.
Yeah.
It's a gender thing. Yeah. It's a sexual orientation thing. And I know that there are so many people that can relate to be having to bring in the diversity, whatever identity that means, and how it seems like it's a positive, but you have to ask yourself, who is it positive for? And is just because, like, diversity doesn't equal, like, positive.
Inclusion.
Yeah, diversity doesn't equal inclusion, and diversity doesn't equal, you have to ask yourself, is it meaningful?
Yeah.
And then, like, it's okay to be annoyed and frustrated to be the diversity. And I think, like, sometimes we don't feel like we can complain about it because it's like, oh, we're getting a PhD. That's really good school. And I know a part of it is because they were seeking diversity. Yeah. So I can't complain. So I can't complain about anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's wrong. Like, we have just as much of a right to complain.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so sad that I feel like that all the time.
I know, I do too.
I shouldn't say anything because I'm privileged to be in this position, but, you know. Yeah, it's so problematic. But we can't solve everything in a day, so.
No.
That wraps up our What's Being Slept On segment. Thanks so much for listening to us rant.
Yeah, if you have any questions, comments, feedback, if you agree, disagree, please feel free to email us at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram at wokeishpodcast. We always love to hear from you guys. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time.
Yeah, bye.